Welcome to the Herd Health Podcast, a convenient place where you can stay up to date on the dairy and beef cattle industry in Canada. With information shared from our technical services veterinarian team, we aim to bring producers, ranchers, and veterinarians relevant insights on trends, management practices, and science that can be applied in the field. This podcast is brought to you by the cattle team at Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health Canada, a leader in the animal health industry. You can find episodes of our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thank you for listening.
Hello, Herd Health Podcast listeners. This is Heather Hargrave, a member of the cattle team here at Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health Canada. Today, we are sharing part two of a conversation with Dr. Tim Nickel, a member of our cattle technical services veterinarian team, on vaccines. If you missed part one of the conversation, we suggest you find that episode in your feed and start there. In this episode, Tim and I discuss the diseases that farmers and ranchers should be vaccinating for, taking into consideration the type of animals you are vaccinating and at what life stage they're at, and why the timing of vaccination matters. We hope you enjoy this episode. Tim, you've mentioned a few diseases and that some are only available in a killed vaccine, some are available in both. Maybe we can now get into a little bit more detail about what should farmers and ranchers be vaccinating their herds for, knowing and prefacing this whole section of the conversation, they should always work with their herd health veterinarian. But what types of things should they be vaccinating for in their herds?
Right. And one of the things, I guess, that a person should define here as well is when we talk about vaccinating, we're vaccinating for specific components that are in the vaccine. So specific viruses or specific bacteria. And we talk about pneumonia, for example, when we talk about pneumonia vaccines, our vaccines contain certain pathogens that we consider common and that we're trying to protect against. But it's important to recognize that there's a lot of different viruses, a lot of different bacteria that can cause pneumonia. Our vaccines do not contain every single one of those components. Some of that is because for some of those things, they're just not very common. Okay, so we're not going to add that in to a vaccine if we don't need to. But there are other ones that we may not be able to elicit as good of a response as what we'd like. So we don't always have a vaccine for every single one. But coming back to the pathogens, it is something where we talk about core diseases that we're trying to vaccinate for, and we talk about optional diseases that we're trying to vaccinate for. The other thing is when we talk about diseases, oftentimes there's a certain group of animals that are going to be more at risk for certain diseases than other groups. Probably the simplest one is if we talk about trying to prevent abortion or trying to protect that fetus, obviously the animals we're trying to protect there are the cows and heifers that are pregnant. So calves are not pregnant, so we're not worried about trying to prevent abortion in a calf. The one thing is that some of these pathogens can cause more than one disease. So when we talk about our five-way vaccines that contain IBR, BVD, PI3, BRSV, IBR and BVD can cause respiratory disease and other signs in calves, but we also see them affecting those mature animals. And so IBR, we consider that a core vaccine for cows and heifers that are pregnant because it can cause abortion at any stage during the pregnancy. BVD is also one that can cause different impacts on that fetus. We can see abortion. We can see congenital defects, so we can see mutations depending on the stage of pregnancy when that infection takes place. Probably the most important thing is we get a calf that can be born that is what we call a persistently infected calf. So it's immunotolerant. If that infection with BVD virus occurs at a specific stage of the pregnancy, so right when that calf's immune system is developing inside and it gets exposed to that BVD virus, it never learns to mount an immune response to that BVD virus. And as a result, they kind of think that's a normal component of their body. These calves are born and they're full of this BVD virus and they're shedding millions upon millions of virus every day in the environment around them. And they're the main source of infection for BVD virus in a herd. So when you have a PI animal, they're the ones that are going to be the main source of infection for the rest of the herd. And unfortunately, one of the impacts that we see is we see immunosuppression as part of that. So sometimes when we see issues with vaccine response, sometimes that's related to You know, we might have a PI animal in the herd. A good example too is PI animals in the feedlot. There's studies that show the impact of a PI animal in a pen where they have higher sickness, more pull rates for BRD or pneumonia in that pen and even adjacent pens when there's a PI animal present. So it can have big impacts on your herd, on the animal's performance and health. So we have core vaccines. So IBR, BVD being core vaccines for the bred animals. We also see clostridial disease, which is, these are bacteria that are present in the soil and they can last for long times in a spore form in those soils. And as animals graze, they will kind of pick these bacteria up. And they will oftentimes be, you know, no clinical signs until conditions are favorable for those bacteria to grow. And what they do is they will produce toxins. And some of the conditions that they really thrive in is when we have a lack of oxygen in tissues. And a lot of times that's where we have a bruise, you know, some damage to the tissue. Tetanus is a good example. I mean, people are very familiar with tetanus because it affects people as well as other animals. We can see, you know, whenever you have a wound or something, we can get introduction of that organism in there, but then we also get a lack of oxygen in that tissue that can result in this bacteria growing, releasing the toxin. And so we see the same thing occurring in our cattle. One of the common diseases that we see is one called blackleg. I'm sure people are very familiar with that. It is something where, again, probably more of the calf foot disease, but we can see mature animals affected with that as well. And so we count that as a core vaccine for cows as well. When we talk about core vaccines for calves, then we're talking about respiratory disease. So our five-way vaccines, again, IBR, BVD, PI3, BRSV, these are all viruses that can cause pneumonia. And so this is something where we will also incorporate those as a core vaccine for our calves. And one of the things with these viruses is that they're really present in almost every herd. They're not something where you're necessarily bringing it in from outside. I mean, you definitely can bring these viruses in, but if we look hard enough, most herds where we would be able to find these viruses circulating. They can be part of the normal kind of flora that are present in these animals. And especially when we have stress, again, coming back to the best example would be weaning stress is something where we can see pneumonia occurring quite commonly in calves after that. So this is something where vaccinating, and again, planning vaccination, where we try to make sure that the timing fits with the risk, that we have that immune response in place before the exposure, that's critical. The other core vaccine that I would say for calves that's important would be for clostridial disease. Again, blackleg being one of the most common ones that we see animals exposed to. So we do recommend using a clostridial vaccine for calves, especially going out on pasture, because that's, they're, again, soil-borne organisms, that's where they're picking these bacteria up.
So then when we think about, again, going back to that planning piece, it sounds like for beef cattle, because, you know, they obviously in a cow-calf herd go out on pasture for the most part in Canada, it sounds like you probably need to consider making sure you do that vaccination before you turn them out to pasture.
Definitely when we talk about clostridial vaccines, that's something where you want that in place prior to turnout.
Okay.
So yeah, for sure.
And then when you're looking at the cow specifically for reproductive coverage, you, again, just to reiterate, you want to do that pre-breeding if you're using a modified live, correct?
Yes. Sometimes, you know, with beef cattle, beef herds, we don't handle cattle every day. In fact, we handle cattle very rarely throughout the year. And so one of the things we also have to take into account is the practical side of things. So while I will always talk about the best optimal program, I also need to take into account that sometimes this isn't always practical because we are not handling cattle or have easy access to the cattle at the times when it would be the most beneficial to vaccinate. So we need to take into account that sometimes we need to adjust those protocols, but recognize the fact that as we move away from the optimal, that we do sacrifice a bit of protection as we do that. It doesn't mean, and what I always talk about is the immune response. It's not like it's a light switch where, you know, they're either immune or they're not. It's actually a continuum. You know, and so there's another analogy that I typically use is one of the things we're trying to do with vaccination is to create that immune response. And I talk about the immune army and the pathogen army. What we're trying to do is to make our immune army so big that it's able to stomp out the pathogen army before it ever has a chance to cause disease. Okay, that's really kind of the main goal of the vaccination is to build that army up high enough. The challenge is that sometimes we wind up getting a situation where we just have a much bigger pathogen army that it's hard to get a high enough amount. There's still benefit. You know, again, it's not an all or nothing thing, but it's always a bit of a war between the two sides, right? It's always a bit of a balancing act. So the one thing is that when we, you know, for example, if we're not vaccinating a couple weeks before that level of exposure, it means it takes us a little bit of time to build up that army. We might get a few more animals sick, or there might be a little bit more risk associated with it until that immune response takes place to protect against that pathogen army. Same thing when we talk about, for example, the pre-breeding vaccination. I completely 100% say that that is the gold standard. Vaccinate 30 to 45 days before the breeding season starts. And that's going to give your highest level of protection, especially when we talk about BVD and these PI animals. The highest risk, or really the time when that's going to occur, is within the first 4 to 5 months of the pregnancy. If we can have our highest level of protection at that point, that's going to be the part that is really going to be the preventative component of that. And by doing the pre-breeding, that's when we're going to match the highest level of protection with that risk period. The one thing we need to recognize, and the reason why we do annual boosters, is that immune response does decline over time. Okay, that's why we have to go in every year and we boost to get those levels back up. If we didn't do that, then we wind up reducing that army to the point where the pathogen army kind of overwhelms it. Okay, but also need to recognize that for a lot of cow-calf operations, it's hard to get that pre-breeding dose in. So then we look at other times during the year when we're handling those animals that we can give that vaccine. For me, the next best time, so the silver option, if you will, is to do them at scour vaccination time. So scour vaccines, we will be giving those prior to calving. Depending on the vaccine, that's going to fall, you know, a month to 2 months prior to calving is when we're going to wind up giving those vaccines. For me, that's the next best time to give these five-way virals, because you're still close enough to the next breeding season that you still have reasonably high levels for that first 4 to 5 months, again, when we talk about BVD. The bronze level, kind of the good, better, best, the good part of that is going to be, and this is where a lot of people will elect to do it, is to do it at preg check time. The reason why people elect to do it there is because it is a time when they're usually handling the animals. It's easy, convenient. The only thing that person needs to recognize is that we're getting a little further away from the breeding season. Our level of protection is not going to be as high as when we do it either at that scour vaccine time, or especially when, if we talk about the pre-breeding time. But again, it's not that there is zero value to it. It's just we need to recognize that, you know, as we balance out what's easy for us to do and what's best for the animal, or, you know, for the optimal immune response, we need to just recognize that we may not have as high a level of coverage. Doesn't mean that we have zero coverage. I still think there's value in doing it. It's just that we just need to recognize that as we move away from the optimum, that we do sacrifice a little bit of the benefit. But if we're unable to do it at all, then there's no value in it, period. And so, like I said, that's why we do need to recognize that we need to compromise in order to make it easy to do on the farm as well. If I make it so impossible for them to do, then no one's ever going to vaccinate.
Exactly. So if I could summarize this piece of our discussion around the timing piece, if you're vaccinating for those diseases that, like I'm thinking the clostridial type ones that the animals may pick up on pasture, definitely do those before turnout. And then you talked about the gold, silver, and bronze option, or best, better, good. So the gold standard for reproductive disease coverage or disease vaccination would be pre-breeding. The next best optimal time would be when you're administering your scour vaccination. And then the good to provide some coverage as well would be, the third option would be when you're preg checking those cows. Does that capture kind of what you defined as your best, better, good scenario, or gold, silver, bronze?
Yes, for sure. You captured it perfectly there. What I took me 10 minutes to do, you essentially did it in a couple sentences.
Okay.
So.
And then I just want to go back to something that you said a few minutes ago. You were talking about the immune response or the immune reaction.
And this is something that always interests me because as a human, I've received vaccinations in my lifetime. And I always chuckle when I have conversations with people and they're like, oh my gosh, my arm is so sore. The vaccine caused it. And my reaction, having worked in the industry and have administered vaccines to my family's cattle or helped do it, I always say, like, if your arm's sore, that means it's working. Is that kind of the same thing in cattle? Could you maybe elaborate a bit more on what that immune response or immune reaction looks like in cattle and why it actually could be a good thing to see something like that?
Sure. I have a friend of mine who used to say the best day for a vaccine is when nothing happens. Ideally, what people want to see is they don't want to see, you know, animals get any reactions from the vaccines, have any ill effects from the vaccines. They also don't want to see disease. So the diseases that we're trying to prevent, that is, like I said, the best day for a vaccine is when nothing happens. Having said that, you know, your comment about, you know, when we go to get vaccinated, sometimes we'll feel that sore arm, we'll feel a little bit off for, you know, 24 hours. It's not uncommon to see that in our cattle as well. And that really is signs that the immune response is actually responding to that vaccine. Does that happen every single time? No, but it is something where when I get reports of that, for me, that's more kind of a natural response to the vaccine. Sometimes we'll even see a local lump or swelling, and we'll see that in us as well when we get our vaccines, right? But it is something where, you know, a small lump, again, will usually go down. It might take, you know, 2-3 weeks before that resolves. But again, that's probably a more of a normal response to the vaccine. Abnormal responses would be, and some of these are more frequent, some of these are very uncommon. More frequent would be if we get, say, for example, large lumps on a large number of animals that were vaccinated, especially if they form abscesses. A lot of times this is related not so much to the vaccine. It's probably related to administration of the vaccine. And we've got a dirty needle, or we're carrying something in from the skin into that injection site. And so we have an infection that occurs. That does happen. If we don't change our needles frequently enough, or we're not very good at kind of keeping things clean, we may see more of those. So that comes back to just revisiting our vaccine administration and making sure that we're kind of doing best practices with regards to that. The other thing that we can see as that is much more uncommon and are anaphylaxis type reactions. Now, these are very uncommon. Generally, we see these less than 1 in 10,000 doses administered. So, I mean, very rare. It is something where it's not the vaccine. Well, it's not that there's an issue with the vaccine, but it is an individual response. So much like people with an allergy to peanuts. It's not the peanuts that there's something different in those peanuts. It's the person that has the sensitivity, the allergy to it. Same thing in our animals. If we see an anaphylactic type reaction, that is something where it's an individual. It's not because of a defect in the vaccine. It's just that individual is sensitive to a component in the vaccine. That's why they're very rare. But they can happen. And one of the things that I will caution people to try and have on hand, there are some medications that we can use to treat those if we see them. I will say that and epinephrine is really the treatment of choice for those cases. I will recommend that people have that on hand at the shoot because these animals, if you have to run to the house, that may take too much time. If you don't have it on hand and you have to run to the clinic, that animal is probably, if it's having a full anaphylactic reaction, you're not going to have time to do that. So it is something where just to be aware, but it is very rare. You know, it is something where for many producers, they may never go through that experience.
We've spent a lot of time talking about reproductive diseases that and vaccines that are available. We've talked about respiratory, that pneumonia component, and then obviously the clostridial stuff that you kind of consider a part of like the core vaccination program for a cow herd. Are there other vaccines then out there that are available that are maybe what I would call nice to have or that are available and could be used in a specific situation?
Good question. And this is, again, where it comes down to talking with your herd veterinarian, because they're going to be aware of specific diseases that you may be at risk for. Sometimes it's because of where you live, the geography that you live in, that we might see those organisms more commonly. Or there may be something that you do on your operation that puts you more at risk. So On the cow side of things, on the bred female side of things, there's a couple of different organisms that we look at. Leptospirosis is a bacteria that can cause problems with abortions. Sometimes we may see weak calves. This is something where definitely we can see this affecting a herd, especially on the beef side. On the dairy side, it's much more common. And a lot of that comes down to how we raise our animals. Out on pasture, there's probably a lot lower risk. In the dairy barn where we keep our dairy cows, there's a lot more risk of transmission of that bacteria because it's spread through the urine. It's not that we can't see any risk in beef herds, but it is something where usually we don't vaccinate for lepto in beef herds unless we have a history where we've diagnosed that. Because we can have a carrier animal that can be hard to identify, then there may be some justification for vaccinating for lepto. Another organism that can cause issues, and not so much with abortion, but just infertility, so it can affect conception rates, is one called Vibrio or Campylobacter is the formal name of the bacteria. It's a sexually transmitted disease, so it's spread by the bull. So the bull breeds a cow that is infected with this bacteria, and then will spread it to every other female that he breeds after that. And this is a disease that we see probably the highest risk is for producers that are taking their cattle to a community pasture. So a community pasture being one where you have a multiple number of farms that are bringing their cattle all to one grazing site, and they're sharing a bull. So the reason why it's an increased risk is it's kind of like the daycare or kindergarten where you've got kids coming in and they're if one's carrying it, it spreads pretty fast within that group, right? Same thing here is all it takes is for one individual cow or female to have this bacteria, and then that bull breeds it and then winds up infecting the rest of the animals. And usually what'll show up there is not so, like I said, not so much abortion, but we'll see a higher open rate. So animals just not getting bred, or sometimes we may see that not very many of them got bred early in the season, that all of your cows got bred later on. And it's because that bacteria really interferes with conception.
Okay. You talked a little bit about this and it just prompted a question in my head. You mentioned the bulls. So we've talked a lot about cow and calf vaccination. I always think, again, the practical experience, the bulls kind of always may get forgotten. Is there anything specific to vaccination that producers and ranchers that have bulls on their farms that they should consider specifically for bull vaccination? I mean, you just talked about a Vibrio as one consideration, but are there any other things they should think about too for that?
Definitely an IBR and BVD, so our core vaccines for our cows. I would definitely include that, as well as the clostridial vaccines. You know, the bulls can get those diseases as well, and they can, again, be a source of disease for the whole group. There are some other vaccines as well, vaccines for pink eye, vaccines for foot rot. These, are, again, are optional vaccines. There are something where the level of protection that they provide are probably not as good as for some of the other vaccines that we have. Definitely when you talk about clostridial vaccines, they're very effective at preventing diseases like blackleg or tetanus. These vaccines, like I said, their level of protection is not as high. Is there value in treating the whole cow herd? Maybe not. I mean, it's worth the discussion with your veterinarian, but it is something where when we talk about the bull, I mean, one bull that's lame is a bigger impact than one cow that's lame from foot rot, right? If that bull's lame, he's not breeding. If that bull has pink eye, again, he's not breeding. And that has a bigger impact than an individual cow that might get pink eye or foot rot. So a lot of times we may consider using vaccines like this in the bull, just because he is such a critical, I always say the bull is half your herd, right? If something happens to the bull, it means that he's not getting your animals bred, and which means that has a big impact on your bottom line. So it is something where we will oftentimes consider vaccines like that in the bull that we might not consider for the cows and heifers.
Yeah, I've talked to a few farmers in my life, and they've actually said the bull is the most important investment in their cow herd. So why wouldn't, in this case, you take the extra step to make sure that investment is protected properly?
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, he's a critical component of your herd.
So we talked about bull vaccination, and then it also prompted, we acknowledge that beef cows are not necessarily dairy cows. Is there anything specific around types of vaccines available or diseases to consider specific to a dairy herd that they should be taking into consideration or talking to their veterinarian about?
Again, worth talking with your veterinarian just with regards to, again, other diseases that you may be at risk for. As I mentioned, lepto is one where that is probably a much more common component. So instead of using a 5-way, we talk about using a 10-way. So you will see vaccines that have that number designation 10. That just means that we have the 5 different strains of lepto in addition to those viral strains. That's a vaccine that oftentimes is used, like I said, because of the fact that the housing conditions we have those animals in put them at a higher risk for diseases for that lepto infection.
So, Tim, we've talked a lot about cow vaccination, both beef and dairy. We also touched on the bull vaccination. If we switch to those young calves, are there any diseases that farmers and ranchers should be specifically looking for vaccination for? And what, and you know, if you could also elaborate on timing and all of those tips that you've kind of covered already with the cows and the bulls specifically.
Sure. So probably the two most common diseases we see in calves. One is scours or diarrhea. The other is BRD, bovine respiratory disease, or pneumonia. Okay. So those are the two big ones that we deal with. I'll maybe talk about scours first because it's a little bit unique in that when we talk about scour vaccination, the most common way we do it is we're not actually vaccinating the calf. And the reason why we're not vaccinating the calf is because they're most commonly get diarrhea in the first month of life. And again, remember what I said about the time it takes for that immune response to occur? We just can't get ahead of it. You know, they're already getting exposed at a very, very young age. And so what we wind up doing with our scour vaccines is we actually administer it to the cow pre-calving. We mentioned briefly colostrum. And this is something where colostrum is, it's that first milk that calf consumes. And there's a lot of important factors in there, not the least of which are these antibodies that provide protection for that calf to all kinds of different pathogens that it is going to get exposed to prior to it developing some natural immunity to all of those things or prior to responding to some of the vaccines we give. So it's a very important thing for it to get. One of the things that we can do to take advantage of that colostrum is we can vaccinate that cow pre-calving. She builds up a high level of antibodies to these scour pathogens. So there's viruses in there, there's bacteria in there, and that gets passed into the colostrum and then into the calf. Okay, and so we can provide some protection to that calf against some of these pathogens that it's getting exposed to in the first week or two of life that we wouldn't be able to vaccinate for just because we can't get that immune response fast enough. So we do scour vaccination. The one key thing here is that I always highlight, you do need to, this one is key to plan for because you do need to have that vaccination at the right time. So we need to do it depending on the vaccine that you're using. It'll have specific time frames when to administer it to get that peak amount of antibodies for when that colostrum is being made. And that colostrum starts being formed in the last 2 to 3 weeks of the pregnancy. Okay, so we want to make sure that we have those antibodies available. So our vaccination is, we kind of consider it an optional program, but definitely for those people that have gone through scour outbreaks. I mean, it's not the only tool that is necessary, but it can definitely be a big help when we look at trying to prevent these outbreaks. Then if we're talking about pneumonia, you know, we already talked about the viruses. So the IBR, BVD, PI3, BRSV, I keep saying that over and over again. But along with that, with pneumonia, one of the things that we talk about is that oftentimes we see initially a viral infection in the upper airways. And what that does is it paves the way for bacteria to move their way on down. So we have we have bacteria in the upper airways, oftentimes in the back of the throat that kind of reside there. They're not causing any problems until those viruses kind of weaken that defenses in that upper airways, allows them to descend down into the lungs. And then we get a bacterial pneumonia, which typically makes them a lot more sick than just kind of a general viral pneumonia. So in some instances, we would like to incorporate vaccines that also contain these bacterial pneumonia. So Mannheimia hemolytica is one. We can see vaccines as well that contain Pasteurella multocida. There's other vaccines that also contain Acinetobacter baumannii. And so these bacteria can cause, amongst other things, pneumonia. Histophilus is one that actually can cause even broader infection. It can get into the bloodstream and spread to other areas of the body, such as the joints. So we can see joint infections in some of those animals as well. So this is something where we may look to incorporate these vaccines as well, depending on kind of the history of disease in an operation and kind of risk factors. You know, some of the risk factors too would be, you know, if, for example, a farm that is buying in a lot of animals throughout the year, there's more potential to bring something in with that. So this is something where we may incorporate that into our vaccination. When we talk about the optimal time to do that, you know, probably that there's kind of two periods of risk that I think of with calves. One is when those maternal antibodies from the colostrum are starting to decline. So, and that's, you know, 2-3 months of age, 4 months of age, depending. And so we'll oftentimes do them at pasture turnout. So when we're giving, for example, our clostridial vaccine, we'll oftentimes be giving that 5-way viral for that. And there again, if we think that we have calves that are at risk of bacterial pneumonia as well, then we may incorporate those vaccines. And some of these vaccines actually have a combination where you have the 5-way viral in combination with a Mannheimia as part of that vaccine. The other high-risk time for calves for pneumonia is at weaning time. You know, when I talk about stress, I mean, probably the biggest stressor these calves go through is at weaning time. Depending on how we do it, a lot of times we may, you know, people are doing it abruptly. And that can be a very high stress time. And sometimes we're also looking at, you know, we're selling them through an Oxermart. They're going to the feedlot, and there's a lot of big stressors kind of at play there. That's an opportunity where kind of getting in there ahead of time with these vaccines and incorporating one with a bacterial component, because that's really a very likely outcome, is that we're going to see bacteria cause infection in these calves at that point. The biggest thing is just trying to make sure that the producers that are doing that they get paid to do that, right? Because they're giving a benefit to the next person down the line.
And you talked about the best time to use these vaccines is pasture turnout. So then would you say that 3 to 4 month age is also for dairy? I'm thinking of dairy calves specifically that may not end up going out on pasture. Would that be also an optimal time to vaccinate those calves for these types of bacteria and diseases?
It's something where weaning time for dairy calves, oftentimes we're talking about 8 to 10 weeks of age. So doing them prior to that is probably, again, to try and get ahead of that stressful event. Not only are we seeing those antibodies kind of declining, that maternal protection declining, but we're also seeing a stressful event there that we can try and do. And then I don't necessarily look at that 3 to 4 months, but we probably would look at boosting those calves at around 6 months of age. The nice thing, and the magic number 6 months, why do we talk about 6 months? And you'll see that oftentimes on vaccine labels, it's because, again, those maternal antibodies kind of decline at different rates. By 6 months, we're pretty confident that all of those maternal antibodies are gone by that time. And because there is no interference now at all, then we get a better response. So in the dairy side of things, we may look at doing that 6 months of age, just because that will kind of get your most optimal response. Isn't that you don't want to wait until that time, because they're probably still going to be at most at risk earlier on, but we also want to make sure to follow up to make sure that we get a good response in them for later.
And then I'm jumping back to cow vaccination for a second, but again, I'm thinking about, you know, a lot of dairy cows in Canada are, don't go to pasture and they're in a barn all the time. Is pneumonia also a concern for those adult dairy cows? And if so, could we use similar types of vaccines to help address that issue with those animals?
And that's a very good question. I appreciate you asking that. That is something where in the last several years, we are starting to see dairy, like mature dairy animals, and even some beef herds, not as much, but we're starting to see that as well, where adult animals that are dying as a result of pneumonia, and oftentimes due to Mannheimia hemolytica or Pasteurella multocida. So these bacteria that we already just talked about. And it is something where in these herds where we have diagnosed that and we have a higher risk of that, even taking place in the adults. We don't routinely think of that as being a common presentation, but it seems to be emerging. We are starting to look at incorporating that vaccine, so including that Mannheimia hemolytica vaccine into the adult cow vaccination program as well.
Okay, that's a good thing to consider. And again, we're going to say it again, another conversation that you could be having with your herd health veterinarian if you are concerned with that.
Definitely. And oftentimes what winds up happening is it's your herd veterinarian that is making that diagnosis. Probably the most common history that I'm hearing is that, you know, an animal dies, you've got a mature cow that dies suddenly, and not just one, but several. And we open them up and we see just a raging pneumonia taking place. And that's something where vaccination has been shown to be good at protecting against that. But we need to make sure that we're using the vaccine that incorporates the things that we're at risk for.
Okay. Be sure to tune in to the third part of this discussion on vaccines and vaccination, where Tim will be sharing his tips for handling and administering vaccines, how to properly store and handle vaccines, as well as things to think about prior to and the day of vaccination. If you like this episode, please consider sharing a review and subscribing or following our show. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Herd Health Podcast. The information shared in this podcast does not replace the advice of a veterinarian. We encourage you to reach out to your veterinarian for more information about the topics discussed. Boehringer Ingelheim cannot recommend the use of products outside of the Canadian product approved labeling. Find more episodes of this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks again for listening.